Hello, I'm Ross Cabbage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And I can think of no better example of really pushing the envelope here than what we're going to talk about with my next guest, Dr. Catherine Young. Catherine, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Thank you, Ross. I mean, I was going to belt out a song or something, but I will keep it actually a little bit more conservative than that and just tell your viewers that I am a scientist by training, born and raised in South Africa, and have spent my career really utilizing science at the core of everything that I do to either advance science in some capacity or to use it for the good of the world. So that often is either an equity piece or an innovation piece. And because of that, it has led me to many amazing experiences in my career and most recently at the White House, which is why we are talking today.
Absolutely. So, that's good bait whilst we dig in. Okay. So one of the things I said to you is you're a very proud South African, and yet you don't have a South African accent. So where were you born and how long were you in South Africa?
Yes, I was born in Johannesburg, which is the place that most people who visit South Africa fly into and fly directly out and go to Cape Town, which is the kind of tourist mecca of the world, but lived there for 18 years. So my parents and I moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, shortly after I graduated from high school. So spent the first kind of primary, secondary schooling in South Africa.
And I'm an immigrant myself. I love the story of just the chance occurrence that got, I think it was your dad, to be an immigrant.
Yes. So, talk about luck. And I feel like I was born under a lucky star because so many lucky things have happened to me. Knock on wood. Hope I didn't just destroy that. But just really quickly, South Africa really went through a humanitarian crisis known as apartheid, where the white minority ruled the black majority in a very kind of traumatic and vicious way, to put it lightly. Near the end of apartheid, because there were so many sanctions against the country, the United States actually lifted for the first time the sanctions against South Africa that prohibited them from applying to what is called the green card lottery, which is essentially exactly what it sounds like. It is a lottery system where you could put your name in if you were over 18. And, if your name got called, you were the lucky winner of a green card and this amazing opportunity to come to the United States and start a new life, essentially. The sad reality is that my brother, who was at university at the time, had heard about it, came home, told my parents about it, that he was going to be applying for this. And then, of course, my mom and dad were like, well, this sounds great. We should do it too. And lo and behold, my dad's name was drawn in this lottery. And because my mom and I were his dependents, we got green cards. My brother, who was the actual catalyst for this idea, did not. And so long story short, we moved over here to the United States shortly thereafter to activate the green card and to start this whole new life here in the United States under this very, very lucky way of doing it.
And then when your parents said, hey, we won the lottery, what was your reaction? Was it like, dude, I have a life here. What are you talking about? Or was it like, wow, this is amazing?
Yes, like America, granted, back then we had three TV channels. And I think my view of America was based on Beverly Hills 90210, the original series, and series like Melrose Place, the original series. And so that's what I envisioned the United States to be. So, of course, as an 18-year-old, living on the southern tip of Africa, to have this amazing opportunity to move to this land of plentiful opportunities, I mean, it was the most exciting thing to kind of imagine doing.
So it's funny, I was in California last week with a couple of colleagues, one who was a Canadian, one of whom was German. And we shared the fact that to the rest of the world, California is what we think America looks like because we just see it on the TV. It's like palm trees, that's America, right?
That's America. Sunny skies, you know, and palm trees for sure is the idea that I had in my brain. And then we moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, which, you know, I love, but certainly did not kind of dispelled a lot of the misconceptions of what America actually was.
And I love the fact that if you didn't have enough baggage being a white South African, your dad's job certainly didn't, you know, add to your credence. So go and explain what your dad did in South Africa and what he moved to and what, and explains why North Carolina.
Yes. So North Carolina, my dad ended up becoming one of the engineers that ran the plant that manufactured cigarettes for Philip Morris. So he worked for the cigarette manufacturing plant, and that was based in a place right outside Charlotte, North Carolina, which is where we landed. And so, you know, I look back at that time, of course, you know, I would never judge anybody for making a living and providing for their family in the way that my father did. But it there is some irony in the fact that now, you know, the good part of a decade that I've spent my career focused on cancer, and cigarette smoking is one of the causes of the leading cause of cancer death. I do see a lot of irony in that now, for sure.
And your dad had a similar job when he was in South Africa.
He was an engineer, yes. He didn't work for Philip Morris back in South Africa, but that was a new American path.
Okay. And so you move in 18, so you've already completed high school, and then I think you went straight into university, didn't you?
I actually waited for part of a year to become an in-state resident because we were new, and that way, and then I applied to the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, which was literally up the road because as this new South African just freshly landed, I had no concept of the schooling systems that, you know, what was considered a good university versus an average university, you know, no concept. In South Africa, we had maybe 4 or 5 major universities. They were all exceptional. And so the idea that you know, there was rankings and different tiers of universities just didn't even cross my mind at that point. So one day I woke up, went and took the SATs because, you know, didn't know anything about this test. All I knew is that we needed to take it. Did well enough to get into college and went to UNC Charlotte, which, you know, looking back, although it's not one of the biggest schools in North Carolina, I think even just being close to my parents, I think was just such a wonderful, like, safety net for me being in this new country and having them close by, I think was really the priority for me at that point.
Did you move into different accommodation? You stay living with your parents?
I lived on campus because I wanted to experience. I wanted the entire experience, and so I moved on campus. But you know, saw my parents a lot, as most college kids who live close by took laundry back, you know, every weekend, or got some good food and came back to campus. I also spent a semester studying abroad in London, so you can imagine that. I was a very confused accent person because I still had a South African accent at the time, but then I picked up like a slight English accent, and then I had a slight Southern accent. It was, I mean, I confused everybody, which I think is why I went to great pains of just eradicating most accents from the way I speak.
And it works really well. I mean, I can just hear the occasional hint of something when you pronounce a South African word, but that's about it.
You know, it's really interesting what they say, that people who are musically inclined can pick up accents very quickly. And I recognize that I don't sound South African, but there are people when I meet them, I can say 2 words and they're like, where are you from? Because you're not from America. I mean, it is striking how people can pick it up, or some people, you know, just assume I'm American. And I think that's a really fascinating thing as well.
And are you musically inclined? Like, there's actually a piano behind you for those just listening to this.
My family's very musically inclined. I wish I was as musically inclined as them, but I would say that it's not one of the skills I would necessarily rank at the top for sure.
I think you told, I may have misremembered this, but I seem to remember that you brought something back from your home to the college as well. Did your dad have?
Yeah, that was
your free cigarettes.
Yes, this is not my proudest moment as I look back on this, but my, you know, one of the perks of my dad working at Philip Morris was all the employees would get free cartons of cigarettes every week, which none of us in my family smoked. So my dad would bring these cartons back home and they would just like stack up in like a closet under the stairs. And I would just take them back home, back to college every week and just hand out cigarette. I mean, I thought I was actually really popular just because I was just such a great person. It turns out that if you give cigarettes away in college, you actually become quite popular. Because
well, there you go. There you go. We all have to survive somehow, right?
Exactly.
So
I would not be doing that today. Let me.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, we all have things in our past that we've moved on from.
Exactly.
So you majored in biology.
Correct. Yes.
And at the end of your undergraduate degree, so presumably 4 years, mm-hmm. you know, what was going through your head in terms of what you wanted to do?
No idea. like none. I was like, okay, I checked this box of getting a degree and now I got to get a job. Like, and I don't know what it is I want. I knew that I loved It's why I majored in biology. I loved the sciences. I loved learning about the body and physiology and about the brain. And I worked in a lab during my undergrad time, you know, so I got a little bit of lab experience. So I knew there were probably two paths. One was going to be the science path. The other one would be potentially the medical school path. I just couldn't do the medical school math. It just wasn't something that settled in me to say, yes, this is what you should do. And so what I ended up doing, because I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, I did a post-bac fellowship at the NIH for a year. And
Postdoc? No, hold on.
Back. It's like a post-baccalaureate fellowship.
Oh, got it.
Specifically for those who have just graduated undergrad. Okay. So you've got your baccalaureate degree. And it gives you this opportunity to experience what actual science is at the National Institutes of Health. I mean, what an amazing opportunity to actually know what it's like to do science. And you're working with some of the best scientists in the world with the amazing, amazing infrastructure and resources. And so I worked there for a year and I was like, this is pretty cool. And so that's kind of what really sparks the idea of doing a PhD.
And then for that 1 year, for that post-baccalaureate thing, is that like courses? Do you work in a lab? Okay.
You get a very, 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 very tiny stipend. You work in a lab full time. And so essentially you're working alongside either students or postdocs there in the lab or PIs in the lab who are looking for individuals who are interested in science but can do, you know, and can learn the world of science, and you get to kind of have your own project. But the idea is really just to be able to immerse yourself in what lab and the research world really is. And unfortunately, this is actually a program that I think is on the chopping block right now. It's one that I've been quite vocal about because it really sparked my trajectory of science. And I think these types of programs to allow those who are just coming out of undergrad, really at the beginning of their career trajectory, those types of experiences are so critical, I think. And this was one that really sparked that pathway for me going forward.
What did the lab work on that you're in?
It was a neurogenetics lab. It was doing DNA sequencing at the time to see whether or not there were any kind of matches of genes and alcoholism. So I worked at the NIAA and National Institute of Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse. I think I got that right.
It's not one of the better known institutes. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's been many, many years. But it was just an amazing experience. I was studying SNPs, single nucleotides.
Single nucleotide polymorphisms.
Thank you. That's
well, it's a team game. We'll get there together. Yeah. So, given your ultimate PhD trajectory, the fact that you landed in a kind of neuroscience lab, was that just total chance, or did you select that?
Total chance.
Okay.
So essentially what happens is NIH, all the labs who want to take on a post-bac fellow get like a whole treasure chest of CVs, and they kind of go through it and they're like, I want to interview these people. They look like they're a good match. And so I just happened to get accepted into this lab based on them thinking that I would be an okay match for them. So it's actually, I think it's a pretty competitive, at least that's what I tell myself. It was, I think, a pretty competitive.
I mean, if you got in it, it was pretty competitive. I mean, that's, we all mythologize ourselves.
So I took it. I was like, I don't care what lab I'm going to be in. To have this opportunity is just incredible. And it also provided this buffer of trying to figure out what exactly I wanted to do at the time. At the time, I was dating someone who was in medical school. So I was seeing firsthand what they were going through. And I was at the same time experiencing science in a lab. And I was like, I know now.
Okay. Yeah. It was an informed decision.
Yes. Yeah.
And so then you go to a PhD, and this is where you start to become a hardcore neuroscientist.
Correct. So my PhD was in biomedical science, like the degrees in biomedical sciences, but all of my research was in the brain. So I studied brain-derived neurotrophic factor and the role of BDNF in the cardiovascular system. So typically this neurotrophin is thought to be, and is, it's not thought to be, very involved in protective mechanisms of the brain. And the idea that actually being involved in something different, like what I was studying, the regulation of blood pressure as controlled by the brain, was very, very kind of novel at the time. So that was kind of my track in my PhD.
How long do your PhD take?
6 years.
It's funny. So my PhD took 4 years, and that was a year longer than it normally takes in the UK. And so in the US, it's kind of like, It's a big commitment to be in science.
You know, I had a slight kind of hitch in the beginning because I joined a lab and my PI after 2 years decided to move to Texas. And he asked me if I would move with him, and I was like, thank you, but no thank you. Like I wasn't at a place where I could just pick up and move. And so I switched labs. And it was really tough because it was like starting almost all over again. And so, you know, when I think about it in kind of actual time frame, my PhD took 4 years in the lab that I eventually joined, with an extra 2 years added on because, you know, hey, some of us need a little bit longer. And apparently that was my journey was set that it was just going to take a little bit longer.
And which institution were you in for that PhD?
I was at the University of Missouri, and in their kind of cardiovascular center there.
And then, okay, so you get 6 years into the PhD, okay. And do you know what you want to do yet?
I think by the end of my PhD, I knew I didn't want to be an academic.
That's progress.
I think we're chopping away at the things that I don't want to be. This is kind of how I apparently how I figure things out is like, what don't I want to do, or how don't I want to be? But I again, like at that time, careers and job opportunities outside of academia were not necessarily discussed as much as they are today in what we call alternative careers, which is, you know, when we think about academics, probably these days academics is the alternative career when you get a PhD, because so many of us now go out and do other things besides a very traditional academic career. And so, but I thought I had two kind of opportunities ahead of me. One was to stay and do research in some capacity, whether that was to remain in an academic institution or join, you know, a big pharma or whatever. Like hard research at the bench, I thought was one. The other option I thought was teaching. And so I was starting to look at opportunities where I could, you know, teach. And my PhD advisors, because I had two of them, because apparently I need additional help in all these things, they basically said to me, we know that like maybe you don't want to stay in academia, but we really recommend that you think about doing a postdoc. Because that will allow you some time to figure out what it is that you really want to do while getting some experience, additional experience in the science world that could, you know, maybe, I don't know, convince you to stay in academia or maybe not, but at least you'll have. So again, I went that way of like, okay, let's take this buffer of like a postdoc and maybe during that time I will figure out what I want to do. And lo and behold, it actually worked. So
let's unpack that, you know, given what you later ended up doing.
Yeah.
You know, do you think, I don't know what it's like now, but do you think the pathway for developing scientists is optimized in the US? That's an obvious loaded question, isn't it? You know,
it is definitely slanted to encourage those in the academic pipeline to stay in academia, I would say. We are not optimizing for other opportunities outside of academia, 100% not. And I think that's a shame, because there is so much we can do as a scientist outside of academia. Of course, academia it's vital, it is critical, but there are some of us in that pipeline that love science. They just don't want to have their entire career devoted to the discovery pathway of something where you are the world expert in something so, 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 so specialized that will one day have a major impact in something as we learn about our body and the world and all these things. But like for me, I needed something to have an impact a little quicker than that. And I think that's what the confounding factor for me was, you know, maybe the science that I do today will have an impact on somebody's life decades from now, but that's not quick enough for me. I want to be able to do something where I know that the impact is happening much quicker. And that's why I was starting to like look outside of the walls of academia.
So you go, I think, to Cornell in New York to do your postdoc. And then like you say, it's a kind of buffer. It's like, okay, you got a job. You know, you're in New York. It's an exciting city. Are you married at this point? When did you get married?
During my postdoc, yeah.
Okay, all right. And how'd you meet your husband?
Oh, in journal club.
How romantic.
Not many people can say that. Yes. So I joined this amazing lab under Chris Schaefer, who just an incredible, this was in a biomedical engineering school and labs. So the emphasis was slightly different. It was more on kind of the the design and execution of imaging and the use of lasers to be able to do that. So I studied something called three-photon microscopy, which allows us to really be able to visualize what's happening in the brain in real time. And so it was just like this amazing experience that I will forever be grateful for it. It was hard and, you know, physics and like lasers are like not necessarily my thing, but like I learned so much during that experience. But really what the biggest gift that was given to me during that time was that my postdoc advisor, Chris Schaefer, actually took a sabbatical during my time there for a year. He came to Washington, D.C. and did a fellowship under AAAS, which is the
American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Thank you. Yes. AAAS, which provides these fellowships to scientists or MDs. So you have to have graduated already. An opportunity to either work for 1 year in Congress or 2 years in a federal agency. And these agencies vary. It can be agencies that you would think of as a scientist, like the NIH or National Science Foundation, or I'm trying to think of the Department of Energy, which often hires scientists. And then there's others which I, as a scientist kind of studying something in small in the brain, would never have qualified for being hired in. And that was places like the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense. And so the idea behind this fellowship is really, again, kind of like the post-bac fellowship, to provide this kind of learning experience of what it's like to not only work for the federal government in these agencies, but to start to understand the processes that take place, how policies is formed. And at the same time, these agencies gain a scientist for that period of time, which is great, because especially back then there was a complete dearth of scientists in the federal governments, especially in these kind of very specialized agencies like the DoD. And so I went through kind of like this matchmaking process again, where
so your postdoc supervisor had done one of the years.
So he got accepted and did 1 year in Congress and became the science advisor for a Congress member, and just would come back periodically during that year and share his experiences and teach us about the policymaking process from a congressional point of view. And, you know, many of us as scientists, we it's a complete black hole when you think about Congress and how it operates and what happens in federal agencies. And he was bringing all this knowledge back with him. And we designed a course together around science policy. And I was like, I have to do this fellowship. Like this fellowship is a gateway to a whole new world that otherwise would not be open to somebody who just comes out with a PhD, right? Like it's just such a, like I call it a gift, because it really was just such an incredible gift for my career.
Do you know who sponsors it? I mean, does the federal government provide funds for it?
AAAS is its own organization. It's a membership organization. So they're, you know, I think they had their own funding, but essentially there are agreements with these federal agencies that in some instances the federal agencies will pick up the funding and pay. So it's not that AAAS is necessarily paying for everybody, but the agencies are picking up a lot of those bills for the fellows that are coming in itself. So there are very, very kind of concrete arrangements with these federal agencies who want these fellows to come in and work with them for a very finite period of time.
Did you, when you were selected, did you say, okay, I'm done with the lab, or were you viewing it as a kind of sabbatical initially, like your PhD supervisor, like your postdoc supervisor?
So at the time when I was applying for this fellowship, I was simultaneously applying for teaching positions, because I was coming to the end of my postdoc. I knew I was coming to an end of my postdoc. I didn't want to be there forever. And so, you know, again, like these forks in the road where if I hadn't have gotten that fellowship, I would have ended up teaching at some college or university somewhere in the United States. So I knew that I wasn't going to come back to academia. Okay. I just didn't know at the time that bifurcation, which direction was going to take me. And I was just so fortunate to be selected and got the fellowship.
Did you choose which department you ended up in, or was it kind of like, is it like you're allocated?
Yeah, so it is this matchmaking process where essentially it's like this crazy week. You come to Washington, D.C., and then you have these interviews lined up at all these different agencies who have already kind of initiated interest in you because they have asked you to come and interview. So that process is actually already pre-decided by the agencies. Again, they have access to all the CVs. They're looking at your background, the skills that you're bringing in. They're going, oh, this seems like a good set of people to interview for these positions. So you go and interview. It's a crazy week. You're all over DC. And then there's a matchmaking process. So the agency will go, and the department in the agency will go and rank who they've interviewed, and you will go and rank who you've interviewed. And then by some magic, you are paired together and you have your answer at the end.
Did you get your first choice?
I did.
Because you're amazing, you see. And so what was your first choice?
My first choice was the Department of Defense in the Biological Nuclear Chemical Warfare Division. It was this amazing office of just crazy work going on in the world. Like at the time, there was a whole chemical weapons saga in, I think it was Syria. Like, you know, and so the whole office is just like, so in like just laser focused on solving this issue, right? And I'm just like, this is just such a new world. And I remember my first day that I got there, I spoke to my boss, who was always very, very busy. So it was a very short meeting, and she said to me, well, we're going to put you on the FSU portfolio, and you know, we'll take it from there. And I was like, that's great. I was like, I'm so excited. I'm so happy to be here. And I had to like run back to my computer and Google what FSU stood for, because I had no idea. And
so it doesn't stand for Florida State University.
It does not actually do that, because if you do Google it, that is the first thing that comes up. It is the former Soviet Union.
Oh, so, yeah.
So places like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Ukraine, all those countries. And so this was not an office where you just sat in your office all day and like did stuff on the computer. No, you were traveling to these countries and you were with delegations from the United States working with governments to try and help them when it came to potential biological weapons that were left over from the Soviet Union time. So in Kazakhstan, for example, there are these huge bunkers that still house anthrax, and it's just people sitting there. And so, of course, for the United States, it's an issue, you know? And so they work with these countries to help to kind of mitigate any threat around these biological weapons. So that could be, you know, making sure that the storage is safe and that there's no chance of these kind of biological weapons getting into the wrong hands. Or a lot of these countries actually do research on these types of things as well. And so the United States would come in and build ESL level 2 and 3 labs to really help them be able to do their own research, but to do it in a way that it was safe and productive at the same time. And so during that time that I was in the office, the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa happened, and I got shifted from the FSU portfolio to the Western Africa portfolio because there needed to be kind of like this mass focus and manpower behind it. And I got to travel, for example, to Liberia and actually see firsthand, you know, the tragedy of this Ebola outbreak and what it was doing to patients who were lined up in hospitals. And we were working with them because when you walk down the hallways of some of these hospitals, there would be just these fridges that you might find in your kitchen, and you open them up and there'd be all these positive Ebola blood samples just laying in the fridge because they had nowhere else to put them. And And the United States was very concerned about, again, people having access to these types of things and using them as a biological weapon. You could imagine somebody taking that and spreading it around beyond just the countries that were being affected, or bringing it into the United States, for example. So got to experience all of that as well, which was just, as you can imagine, as a little scientist coming out, learning about the brain, this was like a whole new world that I had no knowledge about, but was just the most incredible and mind-expanding career experience.
Did you actually go into hot zones whilst they were hot? I mean, were you in the hazmat suits?
Weren't in the hazmat suit. We were literally just walking around hospitals. I mean,
that sounds like a high risk situation.
Looking back, I was just kind of like, I don't know.
It's like, who's expendable? AAAS student.
You go. This is. I mean, you raise a good point. I'm gonna have to think about that more. But no, I mean, we weren't actually like face to face with the patient. We were in the hospitals, but we weren't in their rooms. But yeah, I mean, it was around. And many people came back, and after I came back, and they were like, "Weren't you afraid?" And I was like, "No." I was like, It was mind blowing, right? Like, it was just such an experience that I didn't even really think about the tragic consequences if should one get Ebola. But you know,
yes. Well, we're all indestructible at a certain age. And I think so how many years were you in the DOD total?
Like 2.5 years.
Okay, and then I think one of the expressions you told me when we talked before is you wanted to leave the DOD, and the expression you gave me was because it was too much government. So can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. You know, when people think about the government, they think, oh gosh, like bureaucracy, right? Slow moving, having to go through many, many layers just to be able to get some memo signed off on, right? And that is 100% true, especially at a big agency like the Department of Defense, just layer upon layer of bureaucracy, and it can be incredibly stifling. You know, like, you think about academia and working at an academic institution as being bureaucratic in some ways, like it was nothing compared to working at an agency as large as the DOD. And I just started to feel like this isn't quite for me. Like this has just been the most amazing experience, and I was so grateful for it. But like, I don't know if this is like how I view the rest of my career, like sitting in, you know, in this office, kind of dealing with some of this really kind of painful ways of how things work. Now, granted, those things are often designed to make sure that by the end, the decision that has been made is the right decision, right? Like, you are, in many of these cases, lives are at stake here for some of these agencies. And so, of course, you have to be incredibly intentional about how you operate and how decisions are made. But for me, it didn't sit well with me in terms of like, okay, I've found my home and I want to work here forever. And I had some colleagues who were AAAS fellows who ended up working at the DOD full time after that, because they did find their home, and that was amazing. But clearly for me, that was not where I was looking to land officially.
I mean, one of the things, and we talked about how there's a dearth of incredibly talented unemployed people in the DC area at present. But, you know, one of the things is, you know, the expectation that each job in the DC area is relatively short, a couple of years before you move on to another one. And that just seems to be the expectation. It doesn't. So in my world, that would be like, oh, this person can't keep a job. You know, they're changing jobs every 2 years. Whereas in Europe, it's kind of like, this is what you do.
Well, don't look at my CV because you won't hire me. But no, I, you know, and to be fair, there are agencies where you have career federal servants who have worked there for 20, 30 years, right? And so perhaps I'm not the norm. But yes, there is a lot of turnover in these agencies, and also, quite frankly, opportunities to either move on and into something different or into a higher position or to try something different, because the opportunities that are available, especially in a place like Washington, D.C., are so vast. that you end up having an array of things at your feet that you wouldn't have known about it, would you have kind of just stayed in academia?
So the next move, how did it happen? Did somebody, you know, were you in a cocktail party in DC and somebody said, Catherine, this is a great job for you? That's what I imagine DC is like.
Oh, for sure. So, but that so I actually thought about this because you asked me this question and I was having a hard time remembering it, but I remember now. I knew that my fellowship was coming to an end. I knew I didn't want to try and find a permanent place in the DoD. And so I started, like everybody else, just perusing job opportunities. And I think what happened, I think I remember sitting in the Metro parking lot and looking at LinkedIn. And there was this job, you know how sometimes they say recommended for you or something. And this job popped up and it was for to become the science and innovation advisor for the British Embassy here located in Washington, D.C. And I was like, oh, that sounds like amazing, because what I was looking for was to be able to still have that tie to science in some capacity. But also because of what I just experienced at the DoD with this amazing international travel, I wanted like some kind of global part of that next job for me. Like that to me was, I was starting to actually define very slowly what makes me excited in my jobs. And the global piece was like the thing that I was starting to get really excited about.
One of the tells of you is that you're very excited and very positive about almost every experience you had, but you're right, this job does sound like, you know, given what later happened, that it was written for you. So describe the job. So now we got a South African American who's now working in the British Embassy.
Exactly. So again, you know, one of my fortes is really confusing everybody about who I am and where I'm from. But what most people don't know is that a lot of the embassies here in Washington, D.C. hire Americans to work for them, because otherwise they would have to kind of ship over diplomats who are very expensive to house and keep. And at the same time, they get people who understand the political and policy landscape in Washington, D.C., right? And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for those people who kind of already have some of the connections and the networks and kind of get how things are operating in a place like D.C. And so I came in and we had a small team, a science team at the embassy, and there are several consulates throughout the US and each consulate has a science team. And so we would work together to really bridge both the United States and the UK together when it came to science priorities for the United Kingdom. So, you know, things like antimicrobial resistance or AMR was a huge priority for the UK at the time. And so we would kind of go back on the US side and start to think about, okay, what can we do on the United States side that really helps? Now, again, at this point, I'm working for the UK. So like you have to change your mind shift here. But like how, if we bring US scientists together and pair them with the work that's going on in the UK, and you bring with that the resources and the knowledge and the know-how, can we accelerate work going forward that will benefit the UK, but ultimately also benefit the US as well? And so we would often think about how do we bring, you know, groups, either groups of scientists or universities or politicians together to kind of really get on the same page about something that was a priority for the United Kingdom, and then kind of try and accelerate work forward by working together. And I think that's the key, right? It's like, it's because we know now, at least in my experience, that a lot of these big complicated things that we try and solve for, we cannot do it ourselves. The UK is not going to solve it themselves. The US is not going to solve it themselves. But when we start bringing, you know, putting the best minds together, then all of a sudden, you know, you may be able to speed things up a little bit. And that was our job.
And then you mentioned antibiotic resistance. Were there particular areas that you focused on? Because I know we're going to end up in cancer, but was there anything in the UK job that related to cancer? Or was it all about just science and...
No, so cancer was one of them, was a pillar of priority. Things like clean energy, for example, and like space, you know. I mean, so it was actually a pretty varied portfolio, but on the health side, AMR and cancer were kind of the two pieces that were very health specific.
And so what did you do? What was a normal day, week, month?
I mean, what I've realized in most of my jobs is it's relationship building, right? So it was understanding what the priorities for the United Kingdom were, kind of working with them and their politicians and their scientists to understand what they were trying to do, and then bringing that information and looking at the landscape of the United States and saying, okay, these are the universities that are doing all this work. These are the experts in this area. These are the politicians who care about this the most, right? And then kind of doing a melding of the minds, bringing them together, creating opportunities to be able to share ideas and to catalyze things forward, creating new funding opportunities for scientists to be able to work specifically together with the US and the UK, you know, those types of things to really encourage scientific discovery together, but with the priority areas of the United Kingdom.
And then I'm going to fast forward a wee bit here. And then after 2 years, you know, again, because that's the turnover. Then this is now like 2017. So this is like the second year of the first Trump administration. And then you get what seems to me your first kind of like quote unquote hard politics job. And one of the things that was fascinating to me is I assumed that, you know, when politicians weren't in power, you know, that, I don't know, they just went and played golf. But you explained that, you know, they have these foundations, and we've all heard of, you know, the Clinton Foundation and various other ones, sometimes for the wrong reasons. But that foundation funds staff and projects going on when they're not in power. And so that was the Biden Foundation that you then started to get involved with?
Right. So the former Vice President Biden, you know, both the Vice President and President are going to have very kind of core initiatives that they focus on in their administration. And for the Vice President at the time, cancer was one of them. So in 2016, President Obama, in the last State of the Union address, kind of put Joe Biden in charge of what was to become the Cancer Moonshot. And this was an effort, a kind of federal government effort to accelerate the rate of progress, double the rate of progress against cancer. And so in the last kind of year of that administration, before the end of it, that there was a huge, huge push within the federal agencies to make progress. Of course, that time was finite. And so at the end of the administration, Joe Biden, together with his wife, Jill Biden, started two things. One was the Biden Foundation, which focused on a couple of things, including military families and education, which were key initiatives of Jill Biden. And then a second organization that they founded was the Biden Cancer Initiative. And that foundation specifically was to carry on the work of the Cancer Moonshot that came to an end at the end of the 2016. And so a lot of the priority areas and the work that had started kind of filtered into that foundation, and they compiled a team to then kind of push that work forward. And I was hired as the senior director of science policy. And my role there was to, again, be a catalyst, bring the scientific communities, the tech communities, the academic centers, the cancer centers together, and figure out how we can work together better around specific priority areas, for example, like data sharing and data standards and those types of issues that were coming from the end of the administration, and us trying to make sure that that work didn't end at that time.
Okay, so I'm going to ask some dumb questions here. So because that is not part of the government, you know, it's going on. Is it just preparing stuff in the hope that eventually it goes into government, or is it actually enacting stuff almost as a private citizen?
Exactly. So what I came to realize is that there's a big difference between the work that goes on in a private foundation versus in the government.
Okay.
The foundational work was really important because it was continuing the momentum. And there was a great momentum that started with the Cancer Moonshot in 2016. The idea was to really continue that momentum, but now it was to rely on, yes, the federal agencies, although we had no power in the federal agencies anymore, but also the external stakeholders that could still do the work, right? And so, again, our goal, our job was to identify who those people were and what organizations were able and had the capacity to actually take on some of this work that was maybe not finished, and to continue it forward. And so that was a big part of what we had to do.
And when does it, you know, this is a non-political podcast, in the current environment, because, you know, that is, you know, its names and its figurehead is a politician. You know, when does the agenda become partisan as opposed to this is just for the benefit of cancer and science?
No, I think the one thing that we benefited the most with that was that cancer has always been bipartisan. In fact, it, within the nonprofit itself, we never experienced partisanship at all. Nobody was ever like, oh, I, you know, it's a Biden name. I'm not sure, you know, I'm going to hesitate working with nobody. The goal was so clear, and the people that we were working with were so dedicated to the mission that it didn't matter. What mattered was that we had this leader of this foundation with the former vice president and Dr. Jill Biden, who were the most passionate, empowered people who wanted to see change happen with this. And so, if anything, they provided this really kind of bolt of energy and urgency into the work, given that they were such high-powered figureheads, and people really rallied around that, to be honest. It's very helpful when you're doing this type of work to have leaders who are seen to be, you know, these really great figureheads. And so, and that's what they were. And they really accelerated a lot of that work forward because of them.
And so you stayed with that Biden initiative until, I think, sort of 2019.
Right.
Okay. Is that just because, you know, it's the turn of the clock, it's 2 years for Dr. Young, and, you know, off we go?
One might think, based on my CV, but no, I was very sad about this. I would not have left after 2 years. But essentially what happened was Joe Biden decided to run for president and made the decision to shut his foundations down, to not cause any issues with the path going forward to the presidency. He wanted to remain completely unaffected by the issues that may have arisen just because of how things go when somebody runs to become a president, not because there are issues, but because people look for issues. And so to avoid all of that, just shut everything down. And he, you know, in one of our last days, he said to us, he was like, I promise you that if I become president, I will reinvigorate this work back into the White House, and we will continue this mission going forward. And he kept that promise.
I think you told me at the time, you said, yeah, but politicians say a lot of things. So he did deliver on the promise, but were you banking on it?
Not at all, because first of all, you are relying on one person to become elected president of the United States. That's like a pretty high stake thing to kind of put all your money on, right? Like that's a tough thing to actually be like, I'm pretty confident that this one person will become president of the United States. And there was a time lag between 2019 and then when he became president. And of course, you know, all of us went on and got other jobs in the meantime. And I became the executive director of a rare cancer advocacy organization that was kind of being built from the ground up. So I, you know, talk about like an experience that I was kind of forced into kind of thinking about it, because like I said, I wouldn't have left the position. It was not something that we were like, we just all voluntarily decided to leave. And so what that actually caused all of us to do was to accelerate to the next level. I think before any of us thought we were ready to do that, right? Like I would never at that point in my life have applied or considered an executive director position, because I just in my own mindset, my own limiting mindset apparently at that time, didn't feel like I was ready for that. But because of that, you know, very forced decision of now having to look for a job and this opportunity coming along, I was open to it for the first time and stepped into it when I probably would have not done that had that situation not happened.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to toot your horn too much, but you are operating at the kind of international level. And so that's perfect for an executive director. I mean,
looking back, yes, but I think just personal limitations and kind of the narratives in my head, I always, you know, this is something I've always struggled with, is feeling not qualified enough or not prepared enough or not, you know, good enough in some capacity. This has always been a limiting thing with me. And so at that particular period of time, feeling that way, I would not have naturally just gone and looked for a job like that. But forcefully, it forced me into that. And I was very grateful for that too, because it showed me that actually I was ready for it. And we are ready. Sometimes we need to take that leap when we don't think we're ready.
So there's clearly two voices. So one is you're not ready, and the other is you're totally ready to apply for this job, because otherwise you wouldn't have applied for it.
Well, I also needed a job. So there was that motivating factor to it. But yes, I was excited about the opportunity of taking something like that on, but I was also very, very conscious of the fact that I felt like this was a huge responsibility, and was I really ready for it? And those are two very conflicting things, but you know, ultimately, I guess the risk-taking part of me kind of won out and took it.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Okay, so then I can't remember the date. So when did we know that Biden won the presidency? November 2020?
Right. Then it starts in like the beginning of January of 21.
So you're watching the TV, they announce that he's won. How long before you see whether the politician who says lots of things, you know, is there an email that goes ping going saying, hey, do you want to come back? I mean,
no, it took a little while. And so the reignition of the cancer moonshot happened actually in 2022. And so, no. So there was not an immediate ping. But I think we knew that it was coming. They were just, you know, having, you know, look, cancer was his focus for 2 years outside of the administration. Then all of a sudden he becomes president and there are many competing the things that he has to focus on, right? But we always knew that, listen, this is what he said, and we believed him and we felt like it was moving, but it wasn't an immediate thing. So it was reignited back in the beginning of 2022.
And then what position are you offered?
I came on as the assistant director for policy and engagement. And again, the Cancer Moonshot team, very, very small. So really had two kind of tracks. One was to think about the policies that needed to be enacted or needed to be changed for and on behalf of cancer patients. And the second part was to really engage with the cancer community. And that meant with the patient community, the advocates, the academics who were doing the research, the biotechs and the pharma companies, everybody. Because again, it's kind of this idea of understanding what the current landscape looks like, who are the big players in this space, what are they doing? And importantly, what do they need in order to do it bigger, better, faster, right? For to get the solutions to the cancer patients. And so a big part of at least the first year that I was there was having these conversations, like continuous conversations with people who were doing the work and understanding how what they were experiencing and what their challenges were and how we could translate that into policy on the other side so that we were hopefully making things a little bit easier for things to be done.
Okay, so I do have to have, here's my silly question that I had to explain, is that you physically moved into the White House and you explained that there's two White Houses.
Yeah. There's the White House that you think of, which is the big white building. That's where the West Wing is. It's where the residence is. It's where the president and the first lady actually live their lives. But it also has the big dining rooms where all the amazing, like if you ever see some of the dinners that they host, it's all, that's where that part is. And then on the White House campus, right across from the entrance to the West Wing, is another building called the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. And it's the building that houses all of the offices for the White House staff. So any of the staff that are really working on the big initiatives for the president are all working in that building. Besides, like, you know, the very essential staff that are working alongside in the West Wing or with the First Lady's office, for example, her office was in the East Wing. Small amounts of teams in that particular building itself.
And then physically, how far away are they?
Oh, I mean, you exit the office building and you walk a few steps and you're into the West Wing entrance. So it's right next door. It's right next door.
And okay, here's my other fanboy question. Okay, so are there lots of Marines that you have to salute along the way? I mean,
there's a ton of Secret Service. So they're keeping us safe. So you're always very nice to them. But yeah, I mean, there are always people in uniform walking around there for sure.
Cool. And so during your time there, and again, there must be a time pressure, apart from the fact that it's cancer and everything else, because you don't know that you're going to get a second term or a first term or whatever, you know.
Yes. There was a sense of urgency every day walking into that office that we had to produce. We had to get things done. And it was the most dynamic, stressful environment I've ever operated in, because every day it just didn't let up. And that's okay, because it is the most mission driven work too. So you're waking up every day with a sense of, we're doing this for the American people, and it's important and we need to get it done. And that just keeps you fueled every day going in there.
And then ironically, it's actually one of your longest jobs, because
it's like, no, what does that tell you about me?
It's you're maturing. Your CV's looking better.
It's looking better. Like, it could be a little longer, but we're getting there. But no, it was, you know, and again, if there had been a second administration, I don't think any of us would have left. So it probably would have been even longer, but it was not to be so.
So are you able, this is a challenge, are you able, without being overtly political, to say what you're most proud of achieving in the Cancer Moonshot?
So the second half of my time there, I actually evolved the work that I did and started to think about, how do we take the mission of the Cancer Moonshot globally? Because, of course, you know, we care deeply about the American people. But when we think about the number of cancer deaths and where, you know, the concentration of them being mostly in lower middle income countries, we felt like we had an obligation to tackle that piece too. And so I started to work kind of at the country level to start bringing countries together to be like, okay, how do we work together here? How do we accelerate solutions? Which is a different kind of strategy compared to when you doing domestic related work and figuring out policy changes and things like that. So So I started thinking about, you know, how do we bring these countries together? And at the end of the administration, the president and the prime ministers of Australia, India, and Japan came together and they announced what was called the Quad Cancer Moonshot. These four countries are affectionately known as the Quad. They do a lot of things together, kind of in the foreign policy space. But this was the first time that they were coming together to really tackle cancer, and they focused on, or they committed to focusing on cervical cancer, particularly in the Indo-Pacific. And, you know, the potential impact for women in that area who are greatly affected by cervical cancer was enormous. And I think to be able to see that from kind of the inception and actually writing the proposal and writing the strategy of how these countries would come together to work together in this way, and then seeing the president and three prime ministers actually announce this was probably one of the greatest highlights of my career. I mean, it was just it was amazing. But ultimately, it was amazing because we knew that it was going to have an impact for women in that area. And that is something, you know, you can go home and sleep well at night for. So it was good.
I bet. And of course, you know, your job in the administration came to an end in January 2025. And I remember when I first contacted you about this podcast, you were like, well, I have a lot on at the moment, but, you know, it's like, no kidding. But then,
that's true.
But what, so this is, you know, perhaps more so than anyone else I've interviewed, it's kind of like, well, where do you go to now? So what, you know, do you go back to the foundation? Do you go in a different direction? What is Dr. Catherine Young going to do in the next few years?
Yeah, so kind of in the short term, I am actually going to continue some of the work that was unfinished at the end of the administration, and that is to kind of lead a coalition of organizations and individuals to launch a global cancer fund. And so this is an idea that we started actually bringing people together right at the end of the administration. My very final day, I had one last meeting, and all the organizations there committed to seeing this work move forward beyond the administration. And so I'm going to help kind of lead that work going forward. So I'm very excited about that because it is something that I felt very passionately about. And it allows me the opportunity to see that work, hopefully to the end, where we will announce the launch of this fund, which would be similar to like the Global Fund, which was launched by President Bush to tackle HIV, TB, and malaria many years ago. And so the idea here, again, really kind of going back to the access piece of, there are people around this world that don't even have access to basic treatments or resources or infrastructure. This fund will help alleviate some of that as well. So really trying to make sure that those around the world have what they need. And so I'm very excited. It allows me to continue working with these amazing organizations and amazing individuals that I've had the privilege of working with, and to hopefully see this through fruition at the end of it. So that is kind of my next step moving forward.
I love that. I think the other story that I'd love to end on is when you took your parents, who were both immigrants, and show them what you did in the White House.
That will be a core memory forever of mine. You know, to be able to bring my parents and give them a tour, and to stand, you know, in front of the Oval Office where the president sits, and to really thank them for everything that they sacrificed to move here, and really ultimately providing me this life and these incredible opportunities. I mean, I think it was just the most amazing experience, and just something I don't think any of us will ever forget.
Catherine, I want to thank you so much for just sharing your journey and your experiences and your passion with the audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun. Thank you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on
@drkamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.